morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Marla Zink from the Washington Appellate Project. I'm here today on behalf of Ronald Parker, whose family and friends are also here in the courtroom. While we raised several issues in the briefing and statement of additional grounds that together or individually would require a reversal for a new trial, I'd like to focus this morning on the two instances of prosecutorial misconduct, unless the court has other questions. Here the state committed two instances of prosecutorial misconduct. The first came early in opening statement, and the second was in closing. The first was that the state created an image of the complaining witness in the very first sentences of opening statement, calling the complaining witness, quote, cute as a button. It's problematic in several regards. This creates the state vouching for the complaining witness, so putting the state's opinion in front of the jury as to how it feels about the complaining witness.
That's just cute?
Cute, not just cute, but cute as a button. And this is there was no question later in the testimony.
Let's say that it's vouching that she is, in fact, cute as a button.
Mm-hmm.
How does that affect the propriety of the truth-seeking function?
I think it affects it in a number of regards. It's important to keep in mind that this is a case that came down to credibility. There were no witnesses, though there were supposedly other people in the room while the alleged acts occurred. No one could testify to having witnessed any of it. There were other reasons to doubt the witness's credibility, both because her sister, who had influence over her, had written a journal of 5 different ways to get rid of my client. Also because there was delay in reporting, because the complaining witness had motivation to want to get out of that house to go to a different school. Because the brother talked about the witness's appearance while she was allegedly telling him about these events. He said that she had a face that looked like she was exaggerating. And we know that my client, Mr. Parker,
is that the opposite of cute as a button?
No, what I'm saying is the prosecutor's trying to create its own evidence and its own vouching and bolstering for reasons why the jury should believe the complaining witness to oppose this other evidence. And like in Glassman, this creates an image.
The prosecutor argues somewhere that the witness should be believed because she's cute? I mean, is that?
Well, I think that's the point of the opening statement. What she said was, you know, this complaining witness, AM, goes by her nickname, and well, pausing, she's cute as a button, giving emphasis, right? It shouldn't be relevant, but of course it is. Of course it's an image that the jury is going to hold with it as it considers this witness going forward, and especially where the allegations here are sexual in nature. It also creates an insinuation that because she's cute as a button, my client somehow
can resist. Is there
any
indication that the jury reached its conclusion about the credibility of this witness based on her appearance?
Well, no, we don't know that, but we never know that, and rarely know that in instances of misconduct, right? And we can't inquire into that. It wasn't inquired into. But I think that there's enough here to show that. And then on top of that, you have the second instance of prosecutorial misconduct coming in closing argument, where the prosecutor misstated the law and shifted the burden to my client, saying that if you have a doubt as to my client's guilt, then it needs to be based on evidence or lack of evidence per element that I need to prove. And then that particular facts, including, for example, any disagreement between the stepmother, the mother of the complaining witness, and my client, any disagreement between them wouldn't go to any element. Well, the state put on the evidence of Shannon Parker. It's the state that found it material to begin with. The complaining witness allegedly disclosed to Shannon Parker. It's relevant to the jury's consideration of whether those disclosures were true and whether her credibility on the stand, both the complaining witness and Shannon, were witnesses that they should take into account. So to tell the jury
let's say we agree that that was a misstatement.
Mm-hmm.
Had an objection been made, couldn't an instruction have easily corrected what the jury was to consider in terms of the law on that issue?
Well, I don't think so, because here you have the prosecutor telling the jury not to look at evidence, and you have an instruction already in the jury instructions telling...
And the trial could reiterate that instruction, could he or she not?
Right. The trial court could reiterate it, and the jury could believe that they could look at the state's interpretation of that. So I think it's a discrediting of the evidence, almost all the evidence in the case. And it also shifts the burden in taking away the presumption of innocence, because it asks the jury to not start from a basis of innocence and then build on that and see if it could reach a verdict. It's asking instead that the jury limit its consideration to only certain elements to only certain evidence, and then determine from that evidence whether there's a reasonable doubt. So I think those two together, especially where you're talking about the cumulative effect of the other errors in this case and the fact that this was a credibility contest, that's what it came down to. And in that situation, what you have is the jury needs to be taking into account everything that weighs on credibility and everything that weighs on the circumstances of disclosure, and whether the veracity of the witnesses should be taken into account. And those are things that it's not this court's job to do, it's the jury's job to do, and that's why it's so important that they be tasked correctly and told correctly what the standard is. So, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, but I think those two instances and combined with the other are sufficient for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Peterson from the Skagit County Prosecutor's Office representing the state of Washington. The state's position is that in the two claims here raising a claim of misconduct of the prosecutor, there was no objection. The trial court could have addressed the issue with the jury, and had there been such a bad situation that the jury was tainted, it could have been addressed at the trial court. That's why we have...
Do you agree that the prosecutor misstated the law on reasonable doubt?
Misstated the law with respect to reasonable doubt? Absolutely not, Your Honor. And, in fact, you have to look at...
There's some instruction that says that it has to be based on evidence or lack of evidence per element?
Well, if I actually put the whole quote in my brief at page 40, and that's at the very end of a long portion of the transcript. And it says, reading the whole thing, next instruction that I want to talk about is instruction number 2. And it tells you what my burden of proof is. All the instruction is packaged is important, but this one is particularly important because in this country, the state government, I need to prove a defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's more than probably did it. It's more than really think he did it, but not quite sure. But it's the higher standard of proof, which is beyond every reasonable doubt. Actually, misstating there, it's not every reasonable doubt. It's a reasonable doubt. Now, if you have a doubt, it needs to be based on the evidence or lack of evidence per crime that I need to prove. That's the instructions that the court is given in every case to the jury. It's based on what the
per
elements
element?
Of the charge. Now, to say that...
And then to follow it up by saying that evidence regarding the credibility of this witness need not be considered because it doesn't go to an element of the crime, a specific element of the crime, you don't think that's a misstatement?
Well, if you're saying you can't consider evidence of credibility to address an element of crime, I would agree with that if you phrase it in that particular way. But if what we have here is a prosecutor saying, you don't have to decide that particular fact with credibility beyond a reasonable doubt to reach a conclusion if you're weighing two people's statements about what occurred, which is what the jury is doing
at
every
what
case.
She argued, essentially, and I'm not sure I've got the exact quote, is that you may have a doubt about whether the mother wanted to get out of the marriage, but it doesn't matter in terms of evaluating the elements I need to prove. You think that's an accurate statement?
I think that's an accurate statement because you don't need to reach a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt about the mother's motives are getting out of the marriage or not to evaluate whether or not beyond a reasonable doubt these events happen.
If she has a motive to fabricate, that doesn't go to the elements of the crime. If she has a motive to fabricate these allegations, that doesn't go to the elements of the crime, so the jury's entitled to be told they can disregard it.
If the complaining witness has a motive to fabricate, based on the mother's understanding that the mother wanted to get out of the marriage, that's something that the jury could consider, but that's
sure
not something that has to.
Of course
to, it is. The jury
and,
doesn't
and,
have
and
to
And the prosecutor
that.
Here argued that she couldn't, that the jury couldn't.
Well, but the jury doesn't have to reach a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt about the motives for the mother getting out of the marriage or whether or not the child had understood that the mother had motives to get out of the marriage to decide the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where the prosecutor, reading the argument as a whole, was trying to focus the jury on. To say, look, there are, in practically every case, there's things where you can find a reasonable doubt in determining a particular fact or not. But the question the jury has to come down to is whether that affects the decision about reasonable doubt as to an element of the crime. And that's, I think, where the prosecutor is appropriate trying to focus the jury. So it was an error. And this is a situation, had it been error, the defense counsel should have brought it up. In fact, I would have think that a defense counsel hearing the argument, believing in context that the argument was doing that inappropriately, would have objected and given the trial court the ability to address the issue before the jury and to say that's a misstatement of the law. And it's incumbent upon the defense counsel to do that for a couple of reasons. One, because it helps us frame this issue. We don't have to get into this argument on the appellate level with judges about what exactly the trial court, the prosecutor was saying, what the defense counsel interpreted, how the trial court, hearing any tone and inflection that a prosecutor may have been giving, may have been taking the comments that the jury...
The argument is that if there had been an objection, the trial judge could have corrected or at least ruled on that objection right then and there.
Made a record and given you more information to be able to decide whether or not the prosecutor, what is crossing this line.
Let me ask you on another subject about the videotape of the child interview that was admitted into evidence and played to the jury. Yeah. As I read the transcript, the objection to it was that it was cumulative, and the judge indicated an agreement that it was cumulative, but decided that the evidence had been found admissible pursuant to the child hearsay statute, it was admissible regardless of whether it was cumulative or not. Is that what happened?
I disagree with that determination that the trial court found that it was absolutely cumulative. Now, I think he said it could be cumulative because there had been testimony.
I'll read you what he said. That was addressed at the hearing. It is cumulative. It's many of the things you said that it is, so I'm not disagreeing. But there's a child hearsay statute rule and case law to go with it that allows for what the child said to someone else to come in under certain circumstances.
Right. So the question is it cumulative to the extent where it should have been excluded? Because that was never developed at the trial court.
My question is, did the trial court admit it because it had previously been determined to be in compliance with the child hearsay statute and for no other reason?
I don't believe that that's why it was admitted. I believe it was admitted because, and you have to recall now, this is the trial judge is not the one who had the child hearsay hearing. He didn't have a chance. In fact, I think on one of the pages,
earlier time,
135, he talks about the fact that I didn't get it. He didn't have a transcript when they were going through this in the trial court. So how he could have ever reached a conclusion that this was cumulative of other trial testimony without having seen the video or read a transcript of what was said during the child hearsay hearing, Exhibit 2, which was in the trial hearsay hearing, I don't think he could have reached that conclusion. And go back and look at the evidence that was before him from the witnesses about the statements that the child made. There was the first disclosure to the older sister during a truth game. That description just said that she had been touched inappropriately. The second, I guess you could say the term disclosure, was the brother saying, and this is what the testimony, the brother saying that the younger sister told him that things had occurred. No description of the events to the jury. The same thing with respect to the mother.
I understand the point. Your point is it's not really cumulative, but is the decision to admit something as appropriate under the child hearsay statute the same as the decision to admit the video recording? Or is it two different decisions?
The court has to consider objections that are made to the admission of things such as child hearsay statements. And the example of counsel in the supplemental brief was a 3-5 hearing. You don't just automatically bring in all the statements if there are other objections. What we have here is the trial court saying, well, if you have other objections, bring them on the record during the course of the video being played, and we'll address them. Well, then there were never any objections.
But the objection to it being cumulative, that was made before the videotape was even offered. I mean, that was the objection about why it shouldn't be played to the jury, is that it was cumulative. And you seem to agree that the trial court needs to consider that objection and make a ruling on it.
I think the trial court, evaluating what it had, did not. Cumulative, therefore being inadmissible, the trial court obviously didn't rule that because it let the video come in.
Well, so it sounds like the trial court determined, even if it was cumulative, it didn't matter because it was admitted pursuant to the child hearsay statute.
I think the trial court should still evaluate whether or not the evidence should be excluded as cumulative, regardless of whether or not a prior judge has already determined that it had been admissible at child hearsay. I don't think this court perceived that by saying it was cumulative, in other words, there had been other statements that the child had made with respect to disclosures, that thereby the court was saying this the cumulative evidence outweighs inappropriate prejudice that comes from admission of this. It was just saying this evidence, and we know that it was closer in time to the incident, and it was just after when the child's in a setting where they have the ability to describe the events and not in a sexual setting of a courtroom. So how the court can automatically reach its obviously accumulative to the point it shouldn't be admitted, I don't think was appropriate, and that was not the intent of the trial court at the time that it was making its rulings.
All right. Thank you.
We would ask the court to affirm the convictions. Thank you.
I can go back first to the statement about the complaining witness being cute as a button and Judge Dreyer's question about, I believe, whether that vouched for the testimony of the complaining witness. If the court looks to the very next sentence, so the argument went, complaining witness, and well, she's cute as a button, and you're going to see her testify this morning after opening statement. So I think there was that link there to the testimony, in fact, explicitly. But even without it being explicitly, I think the court can find that was the implicit point, or at least the reception. I'd also note in terms of the beyond a reasonable doubt misstatement that the state has put forward no instruction that could have cured this if it had been objected to at the time. And indeed, I don't think that there is one, because a simple reference back to the jury instruction, you have the problem that these are lay jurors, and if they look at the to convict or at the instruction number two, they could believe the prosecutor's interpretation there. And if you also look at the duration of the
prosecution. I can think of an instruction.
I'm sorry?
I can think of an instruction.
And what would that be, Your Honor?
That the jury is to consider all of the evidence in deciding whether or not each of the elements have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. And the state hasn't proposed that as a possible cure for this problem. Given the duration of the state's evidence, or the state's argument in closing, and cumulative with all the other errors, I don't believe that that would have cured the issue here had there been a timely objection. And then just in terms of the cumulative argument, I would just also point out the state didn't note the fact that the complaining witness's testimony here was quite detailed. So unlike the Bedker case where the trial court had tailored the child hearsay evidence that could come in to be only that which wasn't duplicated by the child's testimony and the in-court testimony, here we don't have any effort at that. We have a full hour-long video played and then full testimony by the complaining witness with no problems testifying to the facts and subject to cross-examination. So for all the reasons set forth in the opening brief and the briefing and the statement of additional grounds, we ask that in the cumulative or separately that the court reverse and give Mr. Parker a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.